Well, good day to you, wherever you may be. It's my pleasure to be here with Kirk and Scott. How are you guys?
Good, fine, thank you.
How are
you?
Good. Good.
I'm really good, actually. So I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad to be anywhere these days. You know, I realized, and I had a long discussion with some two gentlemen just earlier today, that there is absolutely no hope in human institutions. We have reached the point where any one of the following will bring a demise to humanity as we know life on Earth. Political schemes, doesn't matter if they're far left or far right or anything in between, fascist, communist, capitalist, free enterprise, doesn't matter. Republican or Democrat here in the United States, does not matter. Both parties and really all political actors worldwide are so corrupt and the institutions are so bankrupt that our political diatribes are alone enough to do us in. Then you have the problem of academia and the promotion of political correctness as a religion, which has completely destroyed a person's ability or willingness to think, to be judgmental, to be discerning and discriminating. That alone is enough to do us in. And then you've got, on top of that, fiat currency and central banks and bankrupt economic policy that have virtually every nation on Earth in debt, and some in debt to the tune of, well, greater than a year's gross domestic product, as is the case in the United States. It's irresolvable. And then you have the problem of Islam, the most deadly and demonic religion ever conceived by man, responsible for 99% of the world's terrorism. And then you have the militant nature of the world, where particularly the United States invests catastrophic amounts of money on death and destruction to become the exporter of death by being the world's leading seller of weapons systems.
I was going to say, you don't get that far in debt by making smart decisions with what you do with your money.
No, you don't.
No, that's, the point is they actually borrowed the money to do it. They're not spending.
Yeah, and you know what's amazing? It's not just the money that's been spent on the military. It's this great experiment with wealth redistribution. And wealth redistribution had nothing to do with caring for the poor. It had all to do with ensuring the reelection of those who endorse such bankrupt policies. That when you do that, you punish success and you reward failure. And you get, of course, more failure and less success. And it becomes a downward death spiral from which nations never recover.
Our gross national product for the first quarter was a half of 1%. That's not key. That'll just keep up with inflation. They'll probably readjust that downward.
Yeah, you're talking about the change in gross domestic product was was a fraction of 1%.
Yeah, that growth, that's deterioration.
In almost every report that the Obama administration has put out, they've revised it 90 to 100 days later downward. And so we could be back in a contraction period. And, you know, while the only reason we're not seeing runaway inflation is that business is way too constrained to invest such that it would build inventories at capacity, so that while the feds have diluted the monetary supply through quantitative easing and therefore money being worth less would be the catalyst that drives inflation, we're not seeing it because the underlying strength of the economy is so dismal, and it's dismal because there's no reason for anyone to invest in the future in this country.
People just aren't buying either. They know.
Yeah, they know. And I think
that destroys it even more. You know?
There is a growing number of people who recognize that government ought not be trusted, that politicians ought not be trusted, that religions ought not be trusted, that clerics ought not be trusted, that teachers and academic institutions ought not be trusted, that the media ought not be trusted. There's a growing and growing number of people who have recognized the judicial system is not just, that the police are not there to protect your interest, that the military does not provide for your freedom, that it is not wise to be patriotic. And yet, even with a growing percentage of the population recognizing these things, there is way too great an amount of inertia among those who have rejected these institutions, for them to make a difference against the throngs of people who still cling to them and fan the flames of fanatical stupidity.
Mm-hmm.
So we find ourselves in really, really horrible times. Within 10 years, the world is going to change profoundly and dramatically and negatively. And within just 17 years from now, it'll be all over. Man will have come to the precipice of destroying all life on this planet. That's where we find ourselves.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Good.
From the Christian standpoint, which is also driving this train, is they actually believe that these things have to come to pass for their wonderful Jesus to come back and save them, and that ain't going to happen. I mean,
nope.
So they don't, instead of protesting or trying to dig into God's word and say, look, that ain't what it says, what's the real answer here?
Yeah.
Because this ain't working. They just think it is working, and this is the inevitable outcome. I do hear people say talk like that.
I'm here to provide some really bad news to Christians.
Yeah.
The person that you think is the Antichrist is actually going to be the living embodiment of Paul. The same demon that possessed Paul is going to possess the Antichrist. He's not going to be the Antichrist. He is going to be the Torahless one.
Yeah.
And that rather than come to celebrate Christendom and to establish his church and reward Christians, he is going to wipe out every church on the planet. He is going to incarcerate forever every individual who promotes Christendom.
Yeah, all the leaders of the pack.
Right. And if you are a Christian, you are going to be just a follower of the religion. You're going to be obliterated. If you even survive to this day, you'll be gone. So this person that you think is so horrible that's going to arise is going to establish Christianity as the religion of the world. He's going to be a Christian. And God's not coming back as Jesus Christ. He sure as hell ain't coming back as the Lord. He's not coming back in bodily form. He's returning as Yahweh. He's not coming for a church. He's going to reestablish his temple on Mount Moriah. Not on the Temple Mount, but on the top of Mount Moriah. And when he returns, everyone of elevated position in religion and politics and the military, economics, they're all going to be done away with, swept away, along with the buildings and edifices they have built. God's going to literally toss them into crevices within the earth, where they will become the fodder of worms and bacteria.
I didn't think we would find anything more scathing of Paul and the Christian church until we started doing this one. This is so obviously, you can't hide from this one, the Proverbs 7.
No.
This is just unbelievably simple.
Yes. You know, this whole section on Paul began when God said, right outside the window, my home, right outside, I saw lurking, there this whore, and he said that he saw the thoughtless, the morons, the airheads, the ignorant and irrational, which you have to be a Christian. You've got to be ignorant and irrational to be a Christian. We've talked about why that's the case. I'm not saying that to be inflammatory. It's just a statement of fact.
Mm-hmm.
That for you to believe that God annulled everything that he had said and promised that he said was going to endure forever, and for God to have promised that he's going to reestablish Israel and the Torah and his covenant, and for you to believe that instead of that being true, that it's all for naught, that the Torah is a impossible set of laws that God is disowning because he was impotent and incapable of saving anyone through them, and that he elected to have a pervert, sexual pervert, who was demon-possessed by his own admission, insane by his own admission, come up with an entirely different plan, totally negating everything that he said, so that you could have a new testament and a new covenant based on nothing but make-believe, belief. To believe that, you have to be exactly as God said. He says, I looked outside of my window, and there was the whore, and those with the whore, the multitudes with the whore, were thoughtless. They were absolute idiots. And then he said, and there I made the connection, because there was a young man among them. And that young man, singular, masculine, is Paul. And it goes on to describe his encounter with Satan, and why he chose to decide and ally with Satan. And at the end of this, it will name him by name, Shaul. Now, there was once a King Saul, but King Saul was dead at the time this was written. And so when this speaks prophetically of the whore, and when Yahweh in Yashaya and in Revelation to Yahochanan associates the whore directly with religion, directly with Roman Catholicism, and thus Christianity, directly with Babylon, and with Satan himself, this whore is the founder, found the individual who became the founder of Christianity, and that's all. And he's named right here. He's the only Shaul that the world has known since this time.
Well, even if somehow you were deluded and you thought that Shaul was somebody else, when we finally get to that last verse, you've also got a description of him by his first name, by his chosen name. You've also got the same quote from Chabuk.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry, you can't debate this. You can say, well, I don't believe it, and then walk away, and that's fine.
Yeah, God is his.
You can't debate this and say this ain't so.
Yeah, God is his, is ubiquitous in his denunciation of the founder of the Christian religion, the author of half of its New Testament, in his given name, Shaul, as he is in his taken name, little and lowly, Paulos in Latin. Yeah, there's no wiggling away from it. To deny that Paul is the plague of death, which is what Yahweh calls him, is to deny Yahweh's testimony.
Right.
So this is where we were at the end of our program last week. We were just beginning this passage. It's Proverbs 7:13. And remember, proverb is a marshal. A marshal in Hebrew is a memorable and meaningful saying. So this is something put in vivid language where words are used to draw a picture, and the picture to provide perspective and understanding. Yeah, you ought to love the marshal as an artist.
Yeah.
You can't
forget it. It's an engraved image in your brain.
Yeah. Yeah, you use pen, pencil, and paintbrushes.
Yes, sir.
To draw images. Yahweh uses words. And words establish images in your brain. That's why.
Right. Well, it's all symbolic when you think about it, most of the languages, especially even his language when he started out. He did it for those of us who need to see a picture.
Yep. And she establishes her influence over him, harshly overpowering and binding him. Then she makes him submit to her, brazenly and shamelessly possesses and oppresses him with her presence, and her improper and aggrandizing sayings, which are directed toward him. So why would God be so preoccupied? He's looking outside of his home and he sees this whore with masses of stupid people, ignorant, irrational, following her. And then he says, leading that parade was this lone individual man. And then statement after statement drills down on the relationship between the whore and this man.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we talked about this in the last program. The whore has nothing to do with sex.
No, this is not a love scene. This is someone seizing a soul.
Yeah, when Yahweh, through Yahochanan in Revelation 17, 18, and 19, speaks of the whore of Babylon, he's not talking about sex with a dead nation. The whore represents the feigned and false attraction that people have to religion.
Mm-hmm.
The whore is the beast. The whore is Satan. The whore is the church that grew out of Imperial Rome. The beast. And this beast has a troubadour, according to this proverb. And God is fixated on introducing the world 1,000 years before he would do these things to the whore's pimp. The pimp of the whore of Babylon is Paul.
Absolutely.
The author of half of the Christian New Testament.
He is the most quoted man on the earth.
He is the pimp to the whore of Babylon. And that's what this says. But you know, it's interesting. This ain't any ordinary whore. This isn't, you know, some prostitute that can be beaten by, you know, Paul, by his own admission, was ruthless. He was a vicious man. He routinely beat people by his own admission.
Mm-hmm.
But this whore you can't beat.
And she whooped him, didn't she?
She whooped him. That's what this says. And she establishes her influence over him, harshly overpowering and binding him. What's the first line that Paul cited from this?
Against
that was actually the second. The first was, you know, why are you persecuting me? Yeah, why are you persecuting me? And that's something that Yahweh would never say. You know, I will tell you for certain, just as man cannot kill God, man can't persecute
God. You can't persecute God.
You know, I will readily admit
good luck,
that I am not the fittest, strongest, most virile man on the planet. But, you know, my friend Scott may be. And you know something? I would take Scott and Larry, who was also one day.
Yeah,
Larry was a bodybuilder, man. He was a tough military dude. I would pit both Scott and Larry against God, tie both God's hands behind his back, shackle both of his legs, and if they choose to prosecute and persecute God, they wouldn't last
a millisecond.
Well, unless God was just laughing.
Well, then he just hasn't had to laugh first.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, I don't think he's going to smite me off the earth.
No.
Smite me out of existence. So.
No. Reality, both of you know Yahweh, so you're not going to try to go against him. No one who knows Yahweh is ever going to go against him. But second of all, if you were to... He's going to ignore you. You're going to have your influence on him is going to be about the same as stepping on a scale with a little extra navel length.
Well, I was going to say it'd be no different than if you're walking. Do you feel the skin molecule drop off of you?
Mm-mm.
I assume that'd be the same way for him. He wouldn't even notice.
You wouldn't know.
Whatever.
Yeah. So first of all, when he says that, you know, his caricature of Jesus Christ, who really is Satan, says, why are you prosecuting me and persecuting me? Not possible. God would never make the statement. It's insane for God to make. But here, what we're finding is this introduction that everything Satan says is a lie designed to promote the myth that Satan is God. So if Satan says this, what he's really saying is, I have total control over you, pal. And he affirms this by the second thing that Satan said, which is it's difficult to kick against the goad. That line is from Dionysus' most famous play. It's the most famous line in the play from Dionysus. And what it, in context, what it says is that in Greece, since the established religion had Dionysus as the most celebrated deity. Like, for example, when Hadrian took his lover boy from Jerusalem after trying to name the place after himself and building a shrine to himself. After his murderous deeds in Jerusalem, circa 133 CE, he and his lover boy went off to Athens, and Hadrian was a commissioned zealot in the Dionysian religion, and so he would have, with his legions and his power, been the perfect example of why it would have been difficult to kick against the goat. The goat is that sharp stick that is used to prod dumb domestic animals.
Mm-hmm.
And what it means is that if you're one of the animals in going along with somebody's kingdom, that you're being goaded along as a dumb animal with a prod. And that if you want to stand up against the religious authority, against the political authority, it's going to be difficult, you know. And throughout the time in Rome, if you did it, they crucified you. If you did it during the reign of the Holy Roman Empire, they tortured you to death.
Well, they burn you at the stake.
Burn you at the stake after torturing you for protesting against them in any way. And so that's Paul attributed to his God. And the fact of the matter is that it's Satan who makes it difficult to stand up against religion and politics. What Yahweh says, if you don't stand up against religion and politics, if you don't bow your back to them and walk the other way, you can't even engage in a relationship with me. I'll pay no attention to you. But God's position is exactly the opposite. Yeah, you might find it initially difficult to rebel against religion and politics, but if you're not willing to do so, you're not welcome in my home.
One of the tough parts in this passage that we just did in 7:13 is you've got English translators doing this as seizes him and kisses him and, you know, and all these sexual references. And when he really means to submit and bow.
Right.
Nasak is submit and bow, is to do homage to bow down to.
Right. And it has nothing to do with kissing.
Right. And they go and he kisses him. I mean, go away, you translators.
I know. It is pathetic how has been rendered, so it's difficult to understand. But when you realize that what is the whore's name, according to Yahweh? He has an actual name, and then he has a name which he uses, which also serves as a title. The name that serves as a title, what is it?
The title is Lord.
Lord, from the Hebrew Baal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Baal.
All those same terms.
Mm-hmm.
The Lord. What do lords do?
They rule you. You bow down to lords.
Right. They establish their influence over you. They harshly overpower people. They bind people. They lord over them. They possess them. They control them. What is being described here about the whore's relationship with Paul?
That you are now working for her.
That's
like
right.
It a lump it.
Yeah, the whore is being presented as she is, which is the Lord, as Satan.
Mm-hmm.
And she established her influence over him, harshly overpowering and binding him. She became stronger than him, with greater resolve, and conquered and controlled him, becoming a powerful ruler with high status, oppressive wealth, and military might, akin to Sha'az. As a flashing lightning bolts from storm clouds, accompanied by severe winds. You know what flashing lightning is as it relates to Satan?
Well, it's the way he appears when he was descended. It's the way he appeared to Paul.
I guess, right. That's what Yahweh Yoshek said, that as he witnessed the fall of Hasatan from heaven, said, I saw him as flashing light. How did Paul see him on the road to Damascus?
Absolutely the same way.
Flashing light.
There's a clue.
Right. So Shazaz here is a clue that this is the whore is Satan, flashing light. Storm clouds. Storm clouds, we are told that Hasatan is the prince and the power of the air. And that storms, which are destructive, is therefore associated metaphorically with Satan. And with storms, you have strong winds. the Hebrew word for wind and the word for spirit is the same. It's ruach.
Right, ruach.
There is the positive ruach. Yahweh is ruach. He is spirit. And the set-apart spirit and those who are adorned in the set-apart spirit, all good and great. But Satan is also spirit. And so it's the dark spirit of Satan, the demonic spirit of Satan, that is associated with those severe winds. So there's some very, very strong associations here that shouldn't be missed and shouldn't be rendered kiss. But that's not what God said at all.
No, not at all.
Then she makes him submit to her. Does Yahweh ever ask us to submit to him?
Never. Everything is volitional.
Yeah, everything is volitional. She makes him submit to her. Why? Because she is Satan, the Lord. She directs him to comply with her directives, turning him into an instrument for fighting for her cause, providing him with weapons and engaging him in battle. Brazen and shamelessly possesses and oppresses him. In the in his second letter to those living in Corinth, in the last chapter of that letter, did Paul write anything about his relationship with Satan? Second Corinthians, last chapter of Second Corinthians.
Yeah. Well,
what did Paul say about his relationship with Satan?
Well,
he said the thorn in his side was.
Oh yes, well he's possessed. Well, I'm sorry,
yeah.
Brain dead. Brain.
Yeah.
You know that's he guys me. He had to possess me in order to keep my ego down.
That's what it says. Second Corinthians says Paul writes in his own hand, "I am demon possessed." Then she makes him submit to her, brazenly and shamelessly. Possessing and oppressing him with her presence and her improper and good a Christian. I mean, once you realize that Second Corinthians has Paul admitting that he is demon possessed, that's what the thorn in his side is. It's a messenger from Satan, demon. Once you read that, for you to remain a Christian, then you have become a laughingstock. You become
it's the same
wholly
argument.
And completely irrational.
It's the same argument with Muhammad. I mean, when you
right.
Use, all right, I'm a pedophile, I'm a murderer, I'm a slave trader, I'm a
mm-hmm.
killer,
I'm a rapist, da, da, right?
Da, da, da.
Uh-huh. Right.
And you, as you like to put it, all of a sudden your religious dress up, go away.
Yeah. You know the one survivor who got too cowardly to don the suicide vest and the. The mass murder in Paris,
France.
Yeah, in Paris, France. The Belgian defense lawyer, once this kid was released, extradited to France, he said, "Oh, man, am I glad to be done with him. What a," and he used very colorful language to describe him, but that he was a repulsive individual, just an absolute disgusting brat. And the French defense lawyer that had been assigned to him, oh, said, you know, that's not true. He's just a misunderstood individual. He says, I asked him if he had ever read the Quran. And he said no. Does an Islamic terrorist have to read the Quran to become an Islamic terrorist? No.
No, you don't have to. But,
No.
They can be reformed by it, everybody.
Well, I mean, all you have to do is believe the citations in the Quran from the imam or from your buddy who is encouraging you to be a jihadist. And I am certain that those statements in the Quran were cited to him. But he said, no, I read, you know, people's interpretation of the Quran as they appeared online, which would be people reading like Abu Baghdadi, Ibrahim Baghdadi, who is the head of the Islamic State. His only published sermon post creating the Islamic State was entirely a recitation of Quran statements relative to jihad. And so, you know, it's all you have to do is listen to him. It's not difficult. But, you know, that is the basis of all of this, is that whether it be the Pauline New Testament, or the Quran. Satan has allowed, has not allowed, has encouraged her self-aggrandizing sayings and improper sayings to be directed towards them. Now, in this particular case, it's directed to Pauline Christianity. It's him, singular. Now, you might say, well, why is God so fixated on Paul of Christianity when Christianity is not nearly as deadly as Islam? And since,
well, it depends on deadly to your soul or deadly to your body.
Right. I mean, yeah, and well, and part of it is that the Jesus Christ of Christianity isn't a complete myth. Yeah, the name is wrong. Yes, the title is wrong. Yes, the caricature of him painted by Paul is wrong. But, you know, there is an individual name as Yahusha. He was the Messiah. He did live at that time. He did fulfill Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim. It's that the Christian lies are counterfeits. They're twisted distortions of what God said, and they're vastly more beguiling, particularly harmful to his people, than the outright belligerence of Muhammad. If you believe that Muhammad was a prophet of God, and if you believe that Allah is God, then you are either as dumb as a stone,
or
you're absolutely evil.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the two. You can't read the Quran and come away as a rational, informed person thinking, oh, boy, this is really glorious and true. It's worm rot. It's just despicable. And so God doesn't have a lot to say. He does say a lot about Muslim terrorists attacking Israel, which is really his only beef with them, is that he doesn't care what religion people choose that are Gentile. Doesn't care at all. No one doesn't care about them. They're meaningless to him. All those people playing religious dress up, he doesn't care. Doesn't hear their prayers, doesn't notice their sacrifice, doesn't care. Unless they attack Israel, which then he cares, but from a negative point of view. But Christianity piled its lies right on top of the truth. That's why it was seen right outside of God's home with this horrible, debilitating, twisted counterfeit. Now, it says that this was the words that she brazenly and shamelessly promoted through Paul were self-aggrandizing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's Paul.
Well, certainly Paul was self-aggrandizing. Certainly Paul was an egomaniac. But all he did is reflect the qualities of the one possessing him.
Right. They are cut from the same cloth there.
That is correct. Yeah, Satan's whole problem was ego,
mm-hmm.
and couldn't bear that God was spending time with a lesser being, with humankind, and finding interest in this lesser being, humankind, and therefore chose to rebel, take man down to try to dissuade God's interest in man, and then to get man to view Satan as God. You couldn't be more self-aggrandizing than saying, I'll be above God,
yes, above Yahweh.
Except for it's such a pointless thing for him to do, too. Because from the very beginning, we've talked about this before, from the very beginning, God only needed one.
Right.
God made everybody, everything else is because Adam wanted somebody else.
Well, that's why Satan went into the garden and chose to bring Adam down. That's why, you know, God would have been satisfied with just Adam. You know, I came to realize just recently why Chawa existed. Do you know that immediately after God says, you know, you can eat as freely and without restriction as much as you want from every tree in the garden, but you really ought not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, because if you do, you're going to die. You know what he said next? So what he's done there is he said, I'm going to provide for you a way to choose not to continue this relationship with me, because I didn't create a robot here. I created an individual with a thinking individual with free will. I didn't, you know, if I had programmed a robot to tell me how wonderful I was, that would have gotten wearisome in about 15 minutes. So I have to give you a way to disengage from the relationship. The next words out of Yahweh's mouth, without even taking a breath, was that, you know, it's appropriate. And for Adam's interest, it's in your interest, Adam, that I create someone for you, someone who can meet your needs, that is within your realm, your reach, right before you in your presence. Why do you think that Yahweh created Chawa? And why do you think that line comes out of the same breath as the line about, you can eat anything you want to, just my advice is don't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, because if you do, you're going to die. Why are those two things related?
Because he knew he was going to do it, and he knew that he couldn't live alone. He needed somebody with him.
Yeah, I think that's a good part of it. I think it was also that, Scott, if I gave you the option of you could have a... is there somebody that you've gotten to know in the, before I use this example, somebody that you've gotten to know in the past that you once kind of admired, but then they lost their luster once you got to know them better?
A lot of people, yeah.
Okay. Now think of one of those people.
Okay.
Hopefully I'm not that one of those people, but don't name any names if we know. Okay. What if I were to tell you that your choice in life, and life is going to be forever, is that you could either be totally alone and isolated, or you could have a relationship with that person that you've grown to not like so much because you recognize that they weren't who they claimed to be. What would you choose? Total isolation and being completely alone, or an ongoing relationship with somebody, I'm not so sure I really want to be there.
Choose a person.
I'd probably choose the person. Yeah. At least it's one other thing.
So would 100% of rational people. And so if God presented it such that you either have a relationship with me or you are left completely isolated and alone, 100% of people would recognize that wasn't
even a choice.
Yeah, that wasn't a choice. And so Chawa was needed. Chawa was needed. Man had to choose, had to be given the choice to have a relationship that wasn't God. And it's that relationship, man with his fellow man, that separates us from God at this time. But that's why Chawa is presented there in the same breath. I don't think there's one in a million people that made that connection. But it is a powerful connection because what it does is foreshadows our world today. Do we choose, since no one wants to be totally isolated and alone, do we choose to relate to and to trust and to rely upon human institutions like religion and politics and militarism and patriotism and society's traditions, or do we choose to have a relationship with Yahweh?
Well, you know, in small towns, the Christian church is the community, is the real heart of the community. I mean,
of course.
You join for no other reason than you otherwise you're outcast.
Correct. Yeah, well, try to live in Texas and not go to one.
Yeah,
of
or live anywhere in the South. I mean, that's
right.
It's very hard.
Right.
I'm still awestruck right now by what was just said. The thing is, this person created us, and he wanted us to. Mm-hmm. Free choice meant so much to him.
Right.
It's something that he can't have. He doesn't have.
Correct.
It meant so much to him,
right,
that he was like, you gotta have a different option. That has to be
right.
A feasible thing for you to do.
Right.
And an attractive option.
Yeah.
Right. Attractive? Oh, yeah. Real attractive.
It can't be just be somebody to go talk to. You.
Yeah, no, you're not talking about just your ordinary, but you know, being a heterosexual male, well, I can tell you he created a really, really attractive option.
But it's not just Chawa that he made the attractive option.
Yeah.
By providing Chawa,
yeah,
he then made the option of eating the fruit, something
right.
That was that became feasible at that point. Because if I eat it and she eats it, we ate it together. We're still together. I'm not just cast out on my own, and I'm not by myself. So, right. I mean, all that. Think of how amazing that is.
Yeah, that amazing that he would do that for us, knowing that.
That we were just stupid enough to do it.
and that he would eliminate 99.999% of humankind from a relationship with him. That just one in a million people would choose Yahweh over human institutions and humankind. You know, what's interesting too is that tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And it's actually it's diat, which is the ability to discern that which is beneficial and prosperous and pleasing from that which is rebellious and counterproductive. Diat means it speaks of the antithesis of political correctness. It's discrimination and discernment and exercising good judgment.
Say that real loud for those who are listening.
The Hebrew word diat is the antithesis of political correctness.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean knowledge just in the simple concept of the human understanding of knowledge. No, it is, in fact, discernment. It's the ability to exercise good judgment regarding those things which are beneficial and those things which are harmful, right and wrong, good and bad. It's the antithesis, therefore, of political correctness. It's the process of exercising good judgment, being discriminating and discerning. But you look at that that tree, and God said, you know, if you eat from it, it's actually you're going to get killed. And that's exactly what happened. What the vast preponderance of people with their nesama climbed that tree to climb over their fellow man. And they climbed up that tree to exercise their authority over man. And within 1,000 years of that time, man had become so vicious, God had to eliminate humans with a nesama, save the Noah and the other 7 aboard the ark, because they had become so vicious. And so most people use that knowledge to abuse others. Now, there's a lot of people that just sit under the shade of the tree, and they don't give a rat's patootie.
Yeah.
About what's up in that tree. They don't choose to climb it. They occasionally, you know, stuff falls on their head, but they just try to ignore it. But others climb it. But that doesn't mean that the tree is evil. You can climb that tree all the way to heaven. You can use the knowledge of good that is provided there to find God. You can use your nesama as you scale that tree to come to know who Yahweh is, what he's offering, what's reliable and what isn't, what's good and what's bad, what's productive and what isn't.
Let me ask you something. They obviously must not have understood what death was. They never experienced death. They were,
right.
You know, never even experienced any type of hardship.
Correct.
So now, nowadays, of course, we do, but people will still cling. They would rather hope if Christianity is right, and they will be with their relatives,
right?
Even though Yah said this is not going to happen,
correct? Yeah, it's to
they will walk
it's
away
to
from
make
Yah
sense of death.
They might be able to join them, and but Yah, and Adam, they didn't know what death was really.
Yeah, I mean, expect if when this was when this instruction was made, it was only Adam.
Yeah,
and the fact is that. Adam would have had no concept of death, but dying having one's very presence and nature harmed in this process, which is what the word it essentially says, if you eat of this tree, that mankind will use the capabilities that are provided therein.
To
kill you.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you look at why the flood occurred, it's because man was killing. And if you look at why Yah was returning and wiping out all of humankind, save those who have chosen to participate in his covenant, is because of our vicious and destructive, deadly nature.
Now, when Yah would kill the animal to give them clothing, is that the first time they see death and they get it?
Yeah, it could be. Yeah. It could well be, and that there's a plan. I mean, I think that I don't think they were aware enough at that point. I think that you really have to understand that the skin of the sacrificial lamb that was used to cover their nakedness was a foreshadow of Pesach. And the sacrifice of the Passover lamb.
I don't think they
figured out. Just like when Abraham is having discussions with Yahweh, he didn't get it, but it's still there for us to get. And when the disciples were having discussions with Yosha, they didn't get it, but it's there for us to get.
I guess I kind of agree with you on that, Craig. I don't think you understand what death is until it applies to you.
Right.
I can watch somebody, you know, kill an animal and me eat the animal, and for me that's just that's how I get life, that's how I live,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Whereas if all of a sudden I get hurt, well, now things are much more
intense,
intense for me. You know, maybe they're cast out of the garden and it's the first rainstorm that they ever experienced.
Yeah. My father-in-law was a really, really wonderful guy, and he died 15 years or so ago. And my mother-in-law was deeply in love with him, and their whole life was wrapped around one another. Now, neither of them knew Yao, but during the last few years of my mother-in-law's life, she kept on saying, you know, she missed her husband so much that she just really wanted to. She didn't have any will to live. And then finally her body gave out on her, and she was on her deathbed. My wife was sitting there beside her. And this woman who kept on saying, you know, she was ready to die because she missed her husband so much, when death really creeped upon her, said, I'm not ready to die. Die. I'm afraid to die. And that is the, and what she didn't realize is that, and I've told my wife this, although when you say this to a daughter, it's not something they want to hear, but that her mother only lives on now in her memory. Her mother no longer exists. Her mother did not promote religion. Her mother was a victim of religion, not very religious at that. And therefore, you know, her mother and her father, they just simply ceased to exist. There was no punishment. There's no hell. There's no torture. There's no torment. They only exist now in our memories. And, you know, that's just the way it is. And, but most people, because of death, have created this illusion of religion that makes them feel better about death. But I think that's actually counterproductive.
Extremely.
Right. Are you worried about dying?
Me?
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
No, I'm not either. I'm happy to live because there's a lot to do. And this is exciting. There's a lot to do. And, man, I'm having fun. I mean, I'm writing it. I just concluded a chapter 7 now of observations for our time about what Yahweh had to say was going to occur upon his return. And it's really fun. Can't wait to share it with people.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to do, and living is fun. Death for you and for me, should we even die and not be part of the harvest?
Yeah, we have that option too.
Is just a blink of an eye transition from a physical life stuck in the ordinary flow of time to being empowered infinitely many, many times over as we are elevated from 3.5 dimensions stuck in time to existing in the 7 dimensions, so the 7th dimension at Yahweh's presence. So I know I'm not the least bit bothered by the notion. But that is not to say that I want to hurry the process, because there's so much to do.
There's a lot of fun to be had.
Yeah, there's a lot of fun to have, a lot of benefits. I think that, you know, Scott, if I had died among the plane that Abu Nidal brought down, which was the first act of Islamic terrorism. And if I had been among the people that had died at that time, I would not have known Yahweh, so my soul would have been would have ceased to exist. But, you know, I think there's a lot of other people who may not have come to know Yahweh through this journey that we have all been on.
Absolutely.
So there was a lot to accomplish.
Well, there's no sense in being in a rush when all you have is time. I might not get to experience this ever again. So let's let it run its course. Let's see where it goes.
I've told a lot of people here recently, because there's been kind of a brouhaha over language between one of my very, very good friends. In fact, one of our very, very good friends. It appears to be a misunderstanding amongst him and somebody that wrote something that was religious. And that, from what I understand it, the actual person who had the problem with the language was not the person who was being religious. And there was a mistake, you know, how on electronic media it's so easy to, without a face and a voice, to yeah. misappropriate something. But anyway, one of the things that has come out of it is I've constantly said, and I know every one of you would have a reason to be mad at me for this. I'm not answering emails anymore. I've essentially stopped answering emails. And the reason I've done so is that what I found is that if I thoughtfully read and respond to emails, I don't have the opportunity to devote that same time to translating and writing about what Yahweh said. And so while I, you know, really have some wonderful friends as part of the covenant, the fact remains that that my favorite person to have a conversation with is Yahweh. Sorry, Kirk, you're a great guy.
Okay,
we had a lot of fun for a lot of years, but nobody rates.
Nobody.
No, you know, you're not quite up there at the same level.
No.
And so I'm choosing to spend my time now. Speaking of time,
mm-hmm.
methodically, and I'm slow at it. You know, I write 5 to 10 pages a day through translating and commenting. I choose to spend my time with Yahweh, and that's what I'm doing. And I'm just not answering emails anymore. So that's, you know, we do have a limited amount of time. We all get to choose how we spend it. That's how I'm choosing right now to spend mine.
Yeah, we are. Yes.
And
come to kind of that conclusion. It's very tough to play in electronic.
Yeah.
I don't do it anyway, but we have Facebook, but I don't want to go there. Just more.
There's a reason that Larry, apart from his work, mm-hmm. spends so much time on the Facebook site and confrontation with religious individuals. And sharing the truth with those who are open to it,
right.
but he doesn't translate. And why I'm when I was doing the radio show, I was doing that, but really nothing else but that. And why now I'm working as a translating Yahweh's testimony and writing again, but you can't do all three.
No.
Pick one, because you can do the one without it being a burden, with actually being fun, but you can't do all three. And we are constrained currently by time, and I choose not to be burdened by that. I just say, all right, I've got X amount of time between now and forever. Where am I going to find A, the most personal enjoyment, and B, have the most overall long-term benefit? And I came to realize it's not repeating the same thing over and over again verbally. It's not by answering one email at a time.
Yeah.
It's by writing.
Well, this has these observations have been tremendous.
Oh, this and
the feedback you get from other people has been tremendous. So they absolutely enjoy it.
Well, just because we've been promised time doesn't mean you should waste it, right?
Right.
Do something productive.
Right. Yeah. You know, and the. As we went through Psalm 91, I know that that based upon those promises, I'm going to live to 70. I don't know much beyond that, but 70 puts me really within a year or two of the harvest anyway. And I'm in my early 60s now, and so as I look at all of that, while that's not a lot of time left, we all have a choice as to how we're going to spend it. You know, eternity is a different story. You know, in eternity, time no longer matters.
No.
But now we're stuck in the ordinary flow of time. Time does matter. And so this is what I've chosen to do. And, you know, as we study things like Proverbs 7:13, what we see is that there is a benefit of translating these things, because we can learn a lot about who God isn't.
Yeah.
Now, you guys know that there's a change of voice, and we're going to just to begin this now, but we're going to dive into this meaningfully tonight during the Shabbat show. There's a change of voice and perspective, beginning with Proverbs 7:14. Yahweh began by addressing his children in first person, and he continued to do so through the seventh verse. But then, throughout the intervening six verses, God's viewpoint has changed to reflect the alluring and adversarial ways of the whore of religion. As a result, we are left with two options, both plausible, which I suspect is the intent. If what is following, as I should say, is in God's voice, which is the first option, It shows Yahweh acknowledging that he has personally paid the price to reconcile our relationship with him, and that by doing so, he honored, satisfied, and fulfilled the sworn promises he had made to us in his Torah. This would therefore be in contrast to the whore of religion, who is offering nothing of value. However, since the following presentation isn't exactly and entirely consistent with Yahweh's overall plan and nature, even with the most favorable interpretation of the words and definitions, God may be revealing the strategy the whore has developed to make the religion of Christianity seem plausible. If so, this portion of the religious story is in Satan's voice, the whore's voice. Now, there are several reasons, therefore, that I think it's important to present this discussion from God's viewpoint and then from Satan's. First, I'm not entirely certain which was intended, although I am leaning very strongly to the latter.
You're right.
Yeah.
Sorry, you're right. Yeah. No contest. Go ahead.
Yeah, but no contest, but yet presented such that it is plausible to take the other perspective, which is exactly what Satan does.
Yes.
She lurks outside of God's home, making herself appear as if she's God. So she is saying that I did all these things for you, and therefore I'm God. And they are the things that God has done, just with minor little tweaks here and there. And so, you know, I think it's being presented from that perspective, because that's the only perspective that is accurate of Satan. Minor little tweaks along the way. Presenting himself, herself, as God. You know, the Lord of Christianity is Satan. All of Islam is Satan. So I'm going to present this discussion from God's viewpoint and then from Satan's. First, I'm not entirely certain, you know, as I said, which was intended, although I have a strong lean in this case. But, you know, I think we always ought to be humble in respect that our conclusions aren't necessarily always right. And so we should say, here's the information. You view it yourself, and you come up with what you think. So, since every first-person pronoun throughout this section is common and therefore undetermined rather than masculine or feminine, I think that's pretty interesting. The whore would be feminine. The individual leading the whore's parade, which is Paul, would be masculine. God would be masculine. God presents himself when he's speaking in first person as our Heavenly Father as a masculine individual, as the Father. But in this case, throughout this entire section, all pronouns are common in Hebrew, which means undetermined, masculine or feminine. And there is a reason to suspect that it was written this way in order to demonstrate the allure of Satan, to explain how the devil masquerades as God, to manipulate people into worshiping him, showing how the whore's religious counterfeit could easily be misinterpreted. In other words, this is confusing for the very reason that religion is designed to confuse. The Hebrew word Bible, which became Bible, which is the name also of Babylon. What's the definition, guys, of
with male, with the Lord?
Yeah, and that's Babel. But what does it mean? Confused,
it's being confused,
right?
Like the languages of the of Nimrod.
That is correct. The whore of Babylon is the whore of deception. Therefore, God is exposing us to the whore's favorite tactic. Now, second, it's important that everyone recognizes that translations are products of perspective. Those with a religion to promote will render words in the most religious way. Those who know Yahweh, however, are seeking to share the nature of his covenant.